of session 14, August 22nd, 2006. Now, yes, you're having difficulty with the phrase archetype is a quoted extension, medium, technology, or environment. That's a quote. I'm quoting from page 21 of Cliché of the book from Cliché to Archetype. Now, at the time any new technology came in, it was hidden ground. People weren't aware of it, but it was altering people's senses and ratios among the senses and the media they had at that time. There, because they were being changed, they would start to look at something from the past that resonated with the invisible effects of the new technology, and then that would become a new value. Just so when movies came in, they used novels as the content, and so there was more emphasis on the novels, the older form, while people were being subconsciously, collectively molded by the movie effect. So, new awareness came in with a new medium, but it was expressed by what was retrieved and seemed to resonate with the unknown new effect. Now, since there's no more new environments being extended, in general, under the satellite conditions, every previous form of awareness, which was a new medium, becomes a quoted extension, medium, technology, or environment. And what is creating new awareness where everything is figure is a question he's raising. And in the middle of that, you got the instant replay, which is giving you the meaning before the experience. So the general trend of becoming conscious of something is getting confused here. So the archetype is a retrieved awareness or consciousness, and this is what you see in society from the 70s and 80s, is people grab a medium and they become fanatic about it. All right? So you have the fragmentation of American life, as people became football fanatics, art fanatics, drug fanatics, women's lib fanatics, macho fanatics, all the different lifestyles. And the magazine racks in the 70s expanded with millions of magazines for people having their demographic niche, right?
Yeah.
And what it is people were looking for awareness where they retrieved awareness, since it was very hard to get aware of the numbness you were being enhanced and surrounded by, which is what later became called the dumbing down of America, which is a vulgar way of talking about the very process we're talking about, where old cliches become new archetypes and old archetypes become new cliches. This is what McLuhan is predicting and discussing here about the problem of numbness and what is awareness. And we'll see in the next paragraph, the next quote from Cliche, from again the book from Cliche Archetype, page 58, he says, Alfred North Whitehead mentions in Whitehead's book Science in the Modern World that the great discovery of the 19th century was the discovery of the technique of discovery. The art of discovery itself is now a cliche, and creativity has become a stereotype in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's talking about, he later goes on to say that the discovery of the 20th century was a technique of the suspended judgment, when people find it increasingly hard to determine what the heck is going on and what is a retrieved awareness or what is just basic consciousness, then you adopt a stance of not judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 19th century, there was so much invention going on as the unfolding of our environments to a mixed corporate media under satellite conditions. Back then in the 19th century, these things were being invented and unfolded and having their temporary dominance as new environments creating new revolutions. You could say the telegraph created the American Civil War, the technological industrialism that was in Europe in the 1870s created the Franco-Prussian War, movies and railroads created World War I, radio created World War II, all of these new excitements, and McLuhan defined war as accelerated technological development. So you see the issue of how do you write this out and tease apart the distinctions is what McLuhan is trying to do here. And so this quote again from page 58 of the book from Cliché to Archetype, I'll say it again, read it again, because in light of trying to figure out and tease apart what is cliche, what is archetype, what is creativity, you see that in the 19th century you had a great flood of creativity, but creativity becomes questionable. And this is what Dada Duchamp and Dada and the artists of that period, early part of the 20th century, they started to question originality and invention itself and the authentic innovator and genius, because we were getting flooded with so much invention. And then the disservices of those inventions started to throw the whole process into question. So I'll read again the quote from Alfred North Whitehead.
Sure.
The quote is from page 58 of the book From Cliché to Archetype. Quote, Alfred North Whitehead, McLuhan writes, mentions in the book Science and the Modern World, which was a book, I think, written in the 20s or 30s. Alfred North Whitehead mentions in Science and the Modern World that the great discovery of the 19th century was the discovery of the technique of discovery. They found the formula of how to make inventions. You know, they're probing around in the 1700s, early 1800s, starting to make more and more inventions by the second half of the 19th century. They're just roaring along, making all kinds of stuff. And they're starting to make electric inventions. So Alfred North Whitehead mentions in the book Science and the Modern World that the great discovery of the 19th century was the discovery of the technique of discovery. The art of discovery itself, says McLuhan, is now a cliché, and creativity has become a stereotype of the 20th century. Everybody's trying to be creative, but it's a stereotype. Now, he's using the word cliché here in the traditional sense. It's like old hat. But when we go back to what he said at the top of my book, page 23, he says old cliché is new archetype, and old archetype is new cliché. So he's playing with those distinctions, but here he's being conventional in the sentence. The art of discovery itself is now a cliché, and creativity has become a stereotype of the 20th century. On the surface, it's like he's putting down creativity. But a stereotype or a cliché is the agent of wealth generation, because an old cliché becomes new archetype, and an old archetype becomes a new cliché. And so then you come to the next quote from the book Cliché to Archetype. And this is a long paragraph. This is complex, but it resonates with the Alfred North Whitehead paragraph. This is from page 99 in Cliché to Archetype. Another theme of the... How about you reading this one?
Another theme of the wake... That's bold, the wake.
That's Finnegan's wake.
Yeah. That helps in the understanding of the paradoxical shift from cliché to archetype is, quote, past times are past times.
Unquote.
The dominant technologies of one age become the games and pastimes of a later age. In the 20th century, the number of past times that are simultaneously available is so vast as to create cultural anarchy. When all the cultures of the world are simultaneously present, the work of the artist in the elucidation of form takes on new scope and new urgency. Most men are pushed into the artist's role. The artist cannot dispense with the principle of doubleness and interplay, since this kind of Handiades dialogue is essential to the very structure of consciousness, awareness, and autonomy.
Now that's a pretty good paragraph, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Not in there. Now read the next two paragraphs, two quotes, at the bottom of page 23 in my book. The first one is from, again, from the Cliché to Archetype book, page 117, and then the second quote will be from page 141, the same book. Okay, just continuing reading it.
It might be argued that a main cause of the merging of the archaic attitude to cliché with the modern notion of archetype as a more intense reality resulted from our great variety of new techniques of retrieval.
And the next quote.
Mr. Eliot is quite explicit about myth as a structure of parallels without connectives. Mythic form is necessarily double. Its doubleness is a matter not of matching, but of making, not of the mirror and reflection, but of the lamp and illumination.
Let's go to page 25 at the top and read the next quotes, which is from page 136 of the book From Cliché to Archetype, from James Joyce.
Joyce sets up the chain of cognition and recognition itself.
Now there's that phrase, the drama of cognition and recognition. We've come back to it, right?
Mm-hmm. Quote, in the ignorance that implies the impression that knowledge that finds the name form, that whets the wits, that convey context, that sweeten sensation, that drive desire, that adheres to attachment, that dog's death, that bitch's birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality, unquote.
Existentiality,
unquote.
Okay, so that's a quote from page 18 in Finnegan's Wake, but the whole paragraph comes from McLuhan's page 136 of the book From Cliché to Archetype. So you see, I'm doing a lot with the book Cliché to Archetype here. For several pages now, with lots of quotes from that book, because it's a key book. And you see, he's dealing with the key terms in his own language, his own jargon: myth, creativity, archetype, cliché, intense reality, doubleness. Doubleness is a key term. Comes from Wyndham Lewis did a lot with doubleness. So doubleness is another way of talking about the interplay of cliché and archetype, or what he calls a Hendiades-dialogue, or Hendiades-dialogue. Hendiades meaning you say a word to describe something and then use another word, which is pretty well the same meaning as the previous adjective, but you feel you need to add some different tone with it. So it's like saying, look at that baseball bat. It is both brown and brown, but you use another word that means brown. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you can... Dirty. So that baseball bat is brown and dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Or brown and beige. This is what one of the meanings of Hendiades, a simple interpretation of it. So this doubleness, this flipping of the twins of cliché and archetype, is the conditions we're living under in the 60s and 70s in the macro-tactility, where we're going forward and extending ourselves, but most of the extensions are clichés or archetypes. So it's hard to tell whether we're actually making progress. But we are moving along and having different media experiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is recycling of past times, which are becoming games or pastimes.
Mm-hmm.
As we're in a global Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot, we're in a global waiting situation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, I'm going to read these quotes again and watch how he's wrestling with what is the role of the maker, the artist, in a world that is being made, but is relying on retrieving games and pastimes to have a sense of progressive making. And the thing about Alfred North Whitehead is that in the 19th century, people believed in new technology. It was called the Age of Progress. But after World War I, it began to look bleak about this progression, because such a slaughter came out of the 19th century, known as World War I, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people are wondering... Artists are questioning what is creativity, what is progress. And so by the time Joyce is writing The Wake in the 20s and 30s, he's wrestling with this problem of how pastimes are past times. For example, McLuhan used to quote how the activity of aristocrats in England used to hunt on their horses a long time ago. But once we moved into the industrial era, the hunting on horses became a pastime, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was an aristocratic game,
mm-hmm.
Of going out and getting your dogs to hunt some stuff in the fields of England.
Right. You'd have a bunch of foxes in cages, and you'd let one go and give it 20-minute head start.
Yeah, and that was actually... You no longer need to survive in the fox. But it's replaying a period when you needed to catch a fox to survive, to eat, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a pastime becomes a pastime. So another theme of Finnegan's Wake that helps in the understanding, says McLuhan, page 99 of Cliché to Archetype, another theme of the Wake that helps in the understanding of the paradoxical shift from Cliché to Archetype is, quote, pastimes are pastimes, unquote. The dominant technologies of one age become the games and pastimes of a later age, or art forms, right? Think of games as art forms. The new environment turns the older technologies into games and pastimes. So the dominant technologies of one age become the games and pastimes of a later age. In the 20th century, the number of pastimes that are simultaneously available is so vast as to create culture anarchy. And then just think of all the different cultures that are in touch with their own past, plus the new media-generated past, or the word makes a market past, and they're also able to see other cultures' past. So what are you going to retrieve for a pastime? So it creates cultural anarchy. When all the cultures of the world are simultaneously present, the work of the artist in the elucidation of form, or naming what's coming, or predicting the change is coming. So the work of the artist in the elucidation of form takes on new scope and new urgency. How are you going to do it? Now, McLuhan himself is trying to be the artist and elucidate new form in his book here. Most men are pushed into the artist role. So then it becomes a question, what is the artist? Who's the artist if everybody's pushed into exploring like the artist traditionally did? Because so much is going on in the cultural anarchy. The artist cannot dispense with the principle of doubleness and interplay, since this kind of Hendiades hyphen dialogue is essential to the very structure of a consciousness, awareness, and autonomy. Remember, when you talk to somebody, that is making you aware of yourself because you're translating yourself through someone else in the medium of speech, right?
Mm-hmm.
Next quote from page 117 of Cliché to Archetype, following these themes. It might be argued that a main cause of the merging of the archaic attitude to cliché, the merging of that tribal attitude to cliché, with the modern notion of archetype as a more intense reality, that effect, the merging of the old cliché meaning to the new meaning of archetype, resulted from our great variety of new techniques of retrieval. And remember, archetype is a means of retrieving things. It's a collective memory. So if you got environments of retrieval like movies, tape recorders, TV, and that, the replay, instant replay, in that environment, does the older forms of replay, cliché and archetype, become? See? Gets pretty confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And then another word for archetype is myth. So Mr. Eliot is another quote. This is the third quote, page 141 of Cliché to Archetype. Mr. T.S. Eliot is quite explicit about myth as a structure of parallels without connectives. There's no connections in this cultural anarchy. Mythic form is necessarily double. Its doubleness is a matter not of matching but of making, not of the mirror and reflection but of the lamp and illumination. Then we sum it up with the drama of cognition, which is happening collectively among all the cultures inside the media environment, the fourth world of inflation. James Joyce, quoting from Cliché to Archetype, page 136, James Joyce sets up the chain of cognition and recognition itself. So all that we've been talking about the interplay of cliché and archetype and how that's the drama of cognition, is summed up by Joyce on page 118 of Finnegan's Wake with this quote, which McLuhan is quoting on page 136 of Cliché to Archetype. Here's the quote. This is the stages of apprehension. In the ignorance that implies impression, that knits knowledge, that finds the name form, that whets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweetens sensation, that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, that bitches birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality. You got that?
Yeah. That's poetic. It evokes lots of thoughts and feelings and ideas.
Right, because when you walk into a room, you're going into a new place in ignorance, and you start taking sensory data in. That's the impression. So in the ignorance, that implies impression. If you're familiar with the environment, you're not looking to be impressed because you already know what's there. It's kind of cliché or archetypal. So as you go into something that appears to be unfamiliar and strange, it's this process. This is how the mind forms itself. In the ignorance that implies impression. Now, we're talking about Aristotelian sensory forms awareness, not Platonic Larousseian thought stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the sensory form of understanding the chain of cognition and recognition. And in making recognition, you have to name something. That is a way of becoming aware of the experience you're having. You name it. So, in the ignorance that implies impression, that knits knowledge, that finds the name form, you figure out what's the right name for this, what resonates with the new experience, then that name form massages your ratios, your senses, and it's defined here as whets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweeten sensation, that means becomes archetypal, that drive desire for more, that adheres to attachment, because you want to have the experience that you just named a game, that dog's death, and bitch's birth, then entails the ensuance of existentiality or the carrying on of the waiting phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite a mouthful that Joyce writes there.
Mm-hmm.
What's that noise in the background? Is that you or...
No, the dogs are making noise.
Oh, okay. So, how much more on this tape? We got about half done?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't want to go on too much further. I think it's good to read the next paragraph. There's a lot in that. Maybe the next two, because they're all... Let's just go through the next three quotes, because they're all about this process of drama of cognition. But I'm retrieving earlier writings by McLuhan on the drama of cognition before he started using the jargon of the interplay of cliché and archetype.
Mm-hmm.
All right? But he's talking about how the older cultures did it, or how our own process of cognition makes patterns, and we are to relate it to, in the way of organizing this, to the interplay of media in the global theater leading to cliche archetype interplay, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the, what's he call it, the Hendiades dialogue. So we're going to read a quote, the next quote is going to be from the book Cliche to Archetype, page 148. Then the next quote will be from his literary criticism from the early 50s, and the book, collected in the book, The Interior Landscape, page 34. And then the third quote is from an essay McLuhan wrote for that Renaissance magazine, his literary criticism phase in the early 50s. A quote from 1951, an essay called Joyce Aquinas and the Poetic Process. That'll be the third quote. And that's from page 5 of the, what issue of Renaissance is that? It is the volume 4, number 1, 1951. So we're doing three quotes there, which should resonate all that we've discussed on this session. So are you ready to start reading them?
Okay. One of the etymologies of, quote, matching is, quote, making. And in parentheses...
Now, I just want to remember on the previous page, the thing about Mr. Eliot, it said mythic form is necessarily double. Its doubleness is a matter not of matching, but of making. So the playing of matching, or I, and making the other senses, audile, tactile, the interplay of matching and making is another dialectic that McLuhan set up, like cliched archetype. They're interchangeable. Because in this first sentence, one of the etymologies of matching is making, in other words... Then he has in brackets M-A-C-I-A-N, the Latin root, I guess, of making, looks like the word matching.
Mm-hmm.
You see, matching does come from making. But matching is a visually biased form of cognition. So with that proviso, let's go into it. Study again.
Okay. One of the etymologies of, quote, matching is, quote, making. And then that comes from the root M-A-C-I-A-N. This polarity is inherent in consciousness as such. Certainly, in the cliché to archetype process, if cognition is matching our sensory experience with the outer world, recognition is a repeat of that process. We have seen how dreaming involves a recorso of this waking experience of the day. Quote, the unpurged images of day recede, unquote, and that's by Yeats. That's a Yeats quote. The whole of Finnegan's Wake is a recorso, a scrubbing purgation of private and corporate experience in the collective, quote, dreaming back, unquote, period. Quote, making sense, unquote, is a phrase that indicates repetition of some experience which yields a sudden truth or meaning. In, what's this, a book?
A written thing by Mallarmé.
Uh-huh. Which reveals...
It's called In Le Demon de Langlage. It's like the analogy of the demon.
Mm-hmm. By Mallarmé.
Yeah.
And it reveals a creative process as... a recap of the actual stages of apprehension. That is, creativity is the parallel of cognition, a retracking of the labyrinth of sensation. Ancient mythology is packed with examples of this awareness. Daedalus, the mightiest maker or engineer of antiquity, contrived the labyrinth that enclosed the Minotaur.
Okay, next quote from Interior Landscape. Like what we just read is from 1970. Now we're going back to 1953.
Necessarily, therefore, All artistic imitation first arose from the pagan liturgies or mysteries. If Daedalus was the first to note this relation, Joyce was the first to see in these ancient rituals of descent and return the perfect externalization in drama and gesture of the stages of human apprehension. The retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment, and its art form coincides with its quiddity, except that the artist arrests what is otherwise fleeting.
Now a quote from 3 years before that in Renaissance magazine.
Any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a, quote, minotaur, which must be slain by the hero artist. Anything which interferes with cognition, whether concupiscence, pride, imprecision, or vagueness, is a minotaur ready to devour beauty. So that Joyce not only was the first to reveal the link between the stages of apprehension and the cognitive process,
and the creative process,
he was the first to understand how the drama of cognition itself was the key archetype of all human ritual myth and legend, and thus he was able to incorporate at every point in his work the body of the past in immediate relation to the slightest current of perception.
Right now, the minotaur is like a new medium that devours the beauty or what the values of the culture are. So he's used the word minotaur in two of the paragraphs we've quoted, and he's talking about how the key archetype of all human ritual, myth, and legend is the drama of cognition. So he's saying that the very process of human making sense, taking in data, matching with the world, then replaying it in the making part, because we always flip what we take in, our senses individuated or mutated, this process of cognizing the outer world and then mutating it, which is recognizing, is restated in the doubleness between matching and making, the doubleness between cliched archetype, the doubleness between cognition and recognizing, and the need for human ritual myth and legend for an agreed-upon communal common sense. So all these things are refined by the artist. You have the individual artist of the Western Gutenberg culture, but before that you had the collective artists, the tribes, doing this, miming this labyrinth of cognizing and recognizing in ritual, myth, and legend. So Joyce was able to take all those common patterns of the past, and the last line you read, and thus he was able to incorporate at every point in Finnegan's Wake the body of the past in immediate relation to the slightest current of perception. And the slightest current sounds like electricity. So he would take repeated archetypal themes of HCE and ALP, the man and the woman and the three kids, and relate it to new media environments which altered the current of perception. All right? And especially if you're listening to the radio, he's altering it to the content of the radio environment in Paris. So I'm going to reread these statements because there's a lot in here, but this is McClellan's. If you think of television as the extension of the central nervous system, we've been doing over the last few pages the actual making up from an Aristotelian sensory model of what the central nervous system is, which is the drama of matching and making, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And he brings in the dream. The dream is a big metaphor in Finnegan's Wake. If you experience the outer world, and that's cognition, and then recognition is a repeat of that process, then dreaming is a recognizing of all the cognition that went during the day. Because you replay, as he says, McLuhan uses the word recorso, a replay of this waking experience where the unpurged images of day recede in the dream life. Because the recurso or dreaming is a scrubbing, purgation of both private and corporate in the collective dreaming back. So when you, in collective media terms, people go and work during the day and they used to come home and listen to the news, and the news is like a recap of the day. It served the waking world, collective waking world's corporate world's function of dreaming back, which you do when each individual sleeps, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with all those aspects mentioned, and how Joyce took the ritual drama of tribal gesture as miming the stages of human apprehension, the stages of the individual psychology. So you have a parallel between human cognition and the individual brain or body, mimed by certain phases of technological ritual externally throughout history. The ancient rituals of descent and return were the perfect externalization of the stages of human apprehension, which included the going, the waking state, and then sleeping, where you had the dreaming back. So all human ritual, myth, and legend are a form of dreaming back, or making sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Making sense is the precognition phase, or no, the recognition.
Yeah.
So you got many...
Yeah, cognition is direct perception, and then recognition is fitting it into your framework of knowledge so it makes sense to you.
Yeah, it's fitting it, adjusting it to, it's what we had on the previous page, page 21, two pages back, the endless adjustment of the interior acts and dispositions of the mind, the conditionings of the mind, to the outer world, which is new cognitions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with all that in mind, I'm going to whip through these three paragraphs from three different stages in McLuhan's writing, and hopefully you'll see the resonance and how he's basically talking about the same thing with the shifting of the dialogue, of the terms. So we're talking about the doubleness of matching and making, cognition and recognition, cliché to archetype, a drama and gesture, stages of human apprehension, minotaur and the thing of beauty, all within the labyrinth of trying to understand what Daedalus, the mightiest maker or engineer of antiquity, what he did to get out of the labyrinth that he was enclosed in and trapped by the Minotaur, right? The, what he did is he left a thread, right? He was told by some other goddess to take a thread as he walked through the labyrinth, and when the Minotaur came to chase him because the Minotaur assumed he was trapped, he followed the thread back out. The thread is the recapping of the day's events. It's the recognizing. It's the making sense.
Right.
So we're juxtaposing private cognition with collective cognition. So the television is a collective extension of the central nervous system, the processes of the individual brain or mind collectively by television. Okay?
All right.
So here we go. So one of the etymologies, one of the roots, one of the etymologies of matching is making. So matching and making are very close to each other, right? Very subtle. There's like a gap, a very subtle interval between cognition and recognition.
Yeah, I don't see that, though. In the past where we've talked about matching and making, they're quite different. Matching is like the mirror, and making is like the light bulb. They're not the same.
Right, and that is from a slower phase of the human primitive consciousness. Now remember, the matching, or the eye focus, becomes a colossal environment via literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the electric age comes in, you have a colossal electronic environment of endless data making.
Mm-hmm.
So we start off by talking about the different media worlds in understanding media. We're now going back to the stages of apprehension in the human body to show the analogs that he devised media metaphors for. So yeah, when you're talking about eye culture, it's quite different. It's reflection as opposed to direct illumination.
Well, even if we're just having a conversation and you're saying something, I need to be able to match what you're saying.
And adjust it to your own making formulas.
Right, and then I make something and return it, and then you match with what I made.
Right, now that is two people talking, a very puny environment compared to the collective environments going on right now with all the internet computer data talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
They're miming the same process that two people engage.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when you get into media environments, they're huge and they take on distinct differences.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing matching and making, as we're doing now through conversation, it's very fast and you almost can't make a difference. But there is a slight difference, what he calls the polarity. The polarity is inherent in consciousness as such, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the this is another way of saying the cliched archetype process. You take my cliché, what I say to you, then you relate it to your archetype. That's a recognition, and then you state it, you reiterate it and change it into a cliché, which I perceive and relate to my archetypal process.
Mm-hmm.
So the matching and making are happening pretty quickly. Have we got much time on the tape for me to get these three quotes?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, here we go. One of the etymologies of matching is making. This polarity is inherent in consciousness as such. That means interplay. Polarity is complementarity. Certainly in the cliched archetype process, if cognition is matching our sensory experience with the outer world, recognition is a repeat of that process. We have seen how dreaming involves a recorso of this waking experience of the day. Quote from Yeats, "The unpurged images of day recede." Then, the whole of James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake is a recorso, the whole book, a scrubbing purgation of private and corporate experience. He's mixing the private model of cognition and the corporate media history. It's a scrubbing purgation of private and corporate experience in the collective dreaming back as searching for archetypes or familiarity signposts, and dream back is in quotes.
And what's a recorso?
It's a dreaming back. It's a scrubbing purgation of private and corporate. It's sleep.
Whoa, okay.
It's dreaming.
Oh, all right.
But it's a collective, it refers to a collective dreaming. And we do that with movies and television and the news. And magazines and newspapers. So making sense, in quotes. Making sense is a phrase that indicates repetition of some experience which yields a sudden truth or meaning. In the Demon of Analogy, Mallarmé reveals a creative process as a recap of the actual stages of apprehension. So they're discussing what the artist does. It replays the community's experience. But it's a cliché that acquires a replay, a cliché that acquires archetypal intensity, or vice versa. That is, creativity is the parallel of cognition, a retracking of the labyrinth of sensation. There's the Minotaur's labyrinth. Ancient mythology is packed with examples of this awareness of the drama of cognition. Daedalus, the mightiest, I added the words, drama of cognition. So, ancient mythology is packed with examples of this awareness. That is, creativity is the parallel of cognition. The artist, which is the maker of environments, is paralleling what first nature already does, right?
Mm-hmm.
So creativity is the parallel of cognition, human creativity, inventions, art, and science, a retracking of the labyrinth of sensation, or the drama of cognition, but I'm throwing those words in. A retracking of the labyrinth of sensation. Ancient mythology is packed with examples of this awareness. Daedalus, the mightiest maker or engineer of antiquity, contrived the labyrinth that enclosed the Minotaur. He invented the way a model as an artist or scientist. He created an environment that enclosed the Minotaur. Now, further down, we have quotes in the third quote I'm going to get to, where he says, the Minotaur was ready to devour beauty, but Daedalus enclosed the Minotaur and created a new environment that served as protection for the community. Next paragraph. Necessarily, therefore, all artistic imitation first arose from the pagan liturgies or mysteries. Those were the first rituals and legends and human myth and activity, co-creative and tribal, that art later, as a private artifact, imitated. So necessarily, therefore, all artistic imitation first arose from the pagan liturgies or mysteries. Later technologies or arts were extensions of the early rituals. If Daedalus was the first to note this relation, James Joyce was the first to see in these ancient rituals of descent and return, the pagan liturgies and mysteries, the perfect externalization in drama and gesture of the stages of human apprehension. In other words, he saw in the collective rituals of the past what people began in the literate era to understand as psychology, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the studying of the sensory dynamics by science of our individual senses. The retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment. This is five or seven years before McLuhan coined the phrase the medium is a message, but he's saying it here. The retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment. If you know the sensory characteristics of the moment, then you know what artistic form matches that. The medium determines the artistic form. And its art form coincides with its quiddity. In other words, its essentiality or its essence. So its art form coincides with the medium's quiddity, or the environment that he's replaying, except that the artist arrests what is otherwise fleeting. The artist is a means of making translation and therefore recognizing. So the artist works out a collective series of artifacts, and then the huge macro environments that our culture created become collective forms of the work of the artist, and they arrest what is otherwise fleeting. In other words, a camera, a photograph arrests what is fleeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Third quote, any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a minotaur, which must be slain by the hero artist. Remember, we were way back at the beginning, we were talking about imagination, is that thing not embedded in any senses or extensions of senses?
Mm-hmm.
Remember, is it a state of detachment?
Right.
Well, that is Joyce's definition of beauty. It is not identifying with concupiscence, pride, imprecision, or vagueness, which is like a minotaur or a medium that forms a mesh around you, and you're trapped and conditioned by it.
Mm-hmm.
So the labyrinth of cognition is a minotaur which must be slain by the hero artist, and the hero artist finds a way to create a recognition of the minotaur, or a recognition of its characteristics, of its form, and then expresses its quiddity. It is naming. It is a process of naming. In the ignorance, to quote Joyce, page 118 of Finnegan's Wake, in the ignorance that implies impression that in its knowledge it finds a name form. That's a description of what the artist does. So the artist is finding a way to not have beauty be stirred. All right? Beauty is seeing the form in things, experiencing the form without being molded by its effects. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So in relation to the old role of the artist in doing that, which McCone is writing in the early 50s, is what he recognized later as a media ecologist looking at the dynamics of the 20th century art forms, which were the media environments.
I don't know if it's possible to not be molded by the effects of the matrix in which you experience and perceive the world about you. By definition, it's sculpting you.
No, you. I think we have a quote earlier where you are molded. He says that somewhere. Is that you? Yeah, remember that line? Remember? It cannot be the limits. Remember that whole limits thing? Yeah. The limits of our awareness of these forms does not limit their action upon our sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be unaware and you're being acted on, and you can be aware and you're still being acted on.
Right. So how do you maintain a stance of being detached, the detached observer, without being affected by having your perception be affected by what you're perceiving?
You find you retrace the moment of cognition, which will provide the unique artistic form of that moment, and then you create something that coincides with the art form's quiddity, or of the moment's quiddity. In other words, the artist becomes aware by translating the experience into something else, like conversation makes you aware of yourself. So just like the act of speech is the key archetype of this drama of cognition, it is the act of translation that makes you aware. It's the act of finding the correct art form that has the grammar that expresses the unique form of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll read this second paragraph again with that in mind. You'll see how it resonates with what I just said. Necessarily, therefore, he's answering the question, how do you become aware? Necessarily, therefore, all artistic imitation first arose from the pagan liturgies or mysteries. The pagan liturgies or mysteries were earlier forms to translate the ongoing massage. If Daedalus was the first, and remember, James Joyce named the boy, the young boy, young man in Ulysses after Daedalus. His name was Stephen Daedalus. If Daedalus was the first to note this relation, because he's a Greek, and he's at the period where individual visual space is coming in, and you're starting to make individual art objects as opposed to previous preliterate collective form of pagan art making, pagan rituals. So if Daedalus was the first to note the relation of artistic imitation in paralleling earlier pagan liturgies, Joyce was the first to see in these ancient rituals of descent and return the perfect externalization in drama and gesture of the stages of human apprehension. So he kind of did the opposite of Daedalus.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Daedalus related the new private art form back to pagan liturgies. Joyce related the pagan liturgies to the stages of human apprehension and the creative act.
Right. I'd say you have about 60 seconds to wrap up this side of the tape.
Okay, the retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment, and its art form coincides with its quiddity, except that the artist arrests what is otherwise fleeting. Last quote, any movement of appetite within the labyrinth of cognition is a minotaur which must be slain by the hero artist. Anything which interferes with cognition, whether concupiscence, pride, imprecision, or vagueness, is a minotaur ready to devour beauty. So that Joyce not only was the first to reveal the link between the stages of apprehension and the creative process, he was the first to understand how the drama of cognition itself was the key archetype of all human ritual, myth, and legend. And thus, he was able to incorporate at every point in his work the body of the past in immediate relation to the slightest current of perception.
Okay.
Did I make it?
Yeah, you got a little bit of room to comment, but not much.
We'll comment on that. We'll pick up on that next session.
All right.
Maybe we'll do one more McLuhan session to catch up to LaRouche.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll catch up and... Yeah, we'll at least catch up with LaRouche on the next session.
So what do you think of that? Pretty deep?
Yeah. It's good stuff. So, that's it for today, Tuesday... 22nd of August.
So we get it.